supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, yeah, I know we've been talking about black walnuts a lot with your fabulous phone calls, but you know, we've never done a question of the week to get the details in print about how to process them and how to get the nuts ready for Christmas cookie baking. So we'll do that after we take lots of your non-black walnut phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Amy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, hi. It's Amy from Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Very good. How are you today, Amy?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. What can we do you for?
Well, I have a big vegetable garden and lots of compost bins. They're 10 by 10 by 4. And the rodents have made themselves comfortable in the compost. And then at this time of year, they move into the vegetable garden and the perennial beds and eat the roots or the bulbs or whatever. And I don't know what to do to make life uncomfortable for them, so they go somewhere else.
Okay, so do you know what kind of rodents we're talking about?
Well, I have trapped one large rat. I don't know if it's other smaller things. Nobody's my friend out there. But it's not squirrels. It's somebody who's nesting in the compost.
Okay, so the first question, of course, is are there food scraps in your open compost bins?
It's all open. They're probably the leaves of cabbages and other such things, yes.
Okay, so as we talk about on the show, this is one of the biggest problems. This kind of vegetative material doesn't add a lot of nutrition to the compost. It does feed the microbes that break the leaves, the shredded fall leaves, down into compost. But oddly enough, the thing that contributes the most from the kitchen is coffee grounds, and they don't attract vermin. So that's the perfect combination. What I do, and it sounds like you have a garden about the same size as mine and have as many compost bins going as I do, is I would advise you to invest in one of the sealed black plastic composting units. There's two basic kinds. There's big round ones that you can get from extension services, and they're great. They hold a lot of material, but they don't fold. So, you know, they're difficult to ship and they're a little hard to get home in a normal car. What I prefer is the rectangular ones because they ship flat with four panels, two little sliding doors for the bottom, and a lockable lid at the top. And it's like a lot of stuff in gardening. You make a $7,500 investment up front and you use it for the next 30 years.
So you would use that only for the kitchen waste and all the cut flowers and that kind of thing?
No.
The stems you would put in the regular compost bins, is that correct?
Regular compost bins, open to the air. I will put in all my weeds with a lot of soil attached to them. I put trimmings, you know, prunings into a separate pile, but if I were piling everything together, I would put that in there too. It's just the, quote, garbage that will attract vermin. And what I do is I have a little bin next to it or a giant bag next to it with shredded leaves. And this is the only place where I do layer, because I'll put a little layer of shredded leaves in the bottom. And then when I get a big load of kitchen waste, I'll dump that in and I'll cover that with shredded leaves.
Into the plastic container.
Into the plastic container. Lock the lid. The lid has locking devices that even keep raccoons out. And they take a lot of material. So that's a great way to get rid of your kitchen waste. Over winter, however, all my kitchen waste goes into a worm bin that I have on my insulated porch. The worms love the kitchen waste. The only bedding they want in there is shredded newspaper. And they take that kitchen waste and turn it into better compost than compost.
What do you do when somebody has moved into the beds?
I think you probably have voles, V-O-L-E-S.
Yep, I know what voles are.
If you have stuff being eaten underground and plant roots being eaten. And what I recommend for that is relatively new. And for me, relatively new means something that has been around since the early 90s. And that's electrified mouse traps. So you put some AA batteries in this thing. You bait the chamber with peanut butter just like a mouse trap. You set it down, a little light flashes to tell you it's on, and then you go out every day and check it. And if the light is flashing again, that means you got a dead one in there. And you don't even have to look at it. You can just open the little casing, dump it into the trash, reset it, and move on. That can really keep their numbers down. Where are you again?
Westchester, Pennsylvania, or south of Westchester. But
how would you like to put a raptor perch up in the middle of your garden?
We have red-tailed hawks.
Yeah, there you go. Red-tailed hawks are daytime hunters, and they're very good. And if you stay away and you put up a raptor perch, which is a crossbeam about 5 or 6 feet off the ground on a sturdy pole, they may land there. But the big action is going to be at night when the voles are most active. You will have owls sitting on that raptor.
I'd be thrilled to have owls.
You probably do, but they don't come into the garden because they got no place to stay. So if you put up a raptor perch, they'll sit on that all night long. And the main food of owls is voles.
Oh, good.
That makes up the majority of their diet. And you'll see the evidence. You'll see owl pellets all through your garden with the remains of the voles that used to trouble you. All right?
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Amy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, man. Where are you?
I'm in Pittstown, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. The Garden State. What can we do for you, sir?
Last spring, I bought a bunch of little plants to make a showcase in front of our house, and among those plants were coleus. And they did really well outside, and towards September, they started going to seed. And just before I took everything apart, I reminded myself when I lived in California, people grew those indoors and got wonderful plants with just clippings. So I thought I'd try to transplant them into one pot and bring them inside to see how they would work. So I did that. But right before I transplanted, they had started shooting seed sprouts off, 6 or 8 inches for each plant. And I would just, you know, pick them off with my fingernails. And I brought it in. I transplanted them all into one pot. And it seemed to be doing okay for the first few weeks, but I woke up one day and came down to find that they had all started seeding once again. And it's about the fourth or fifth time they've done that, the first time inside, though. And now I'm concerned if I'm doing something wrong picking the seed sprouts off the coleus.
No, you're on track to do something incredibly right, but something that people generally don't get right the first year. Gardening is a learning experience. But coleus is a great plant. However, like basil, it loves to go to seed before you want it to. So when you got coleus growing outdoors, one of the pieces of advice is as soon as you see that seed stalk coming up, you immediately, quote, pinch it off. And that really means what it sounds like. You just pinch it between your forefinger and thumb.
Right.
And that'll keep the plant nice and bushy. It'll also prevent the plant from thinking that it's finished. One of the things about most of our garden plants is when they begin to produce seed, they're getting ready to exit stage left. The seed is the next generation. So one of the secrets, for instance, of getting an endless string bean harvest is you never let the seeds get plump in the string beans because the plant instinctively knows it has not yet had children. Those seeds are not old enough and developed enough to germinate. So it'll just keep producing more flowers and more fruit. The same is somewhat true of coleus. You keep pinching off those seed heads, the plant will develop all of its strength into more flowers. It'll get bushier, even showier. More importantly, it won't begin the decline. If you let that seed head develop into fully mature seeds, those seeds, you can bring them inside and grow them out. You can grow your next run of coleus. But if you understand what I mean, the plant outside has timed out now because those seeds have matured. So what you want to do, if you want to just bring the plants inside, no muss, no fuss, is keep pinching off the seed heads during the season. And then sometime in September, long before risk of frost, you pot them up into good containers with good drainage using just soil-free potting mix and bring them inside. And then once inside, you keep pinching. You keep taking those seed heads off. Coleus also root brilliantly from cuttings at any time of the year. So once the plant achieves a good size, it's very easy to take a fresh cutting And don't do what most people do. Don't just put it in a jar of water. You will get beautiful roots, but those roots will not survive in soil after that. You take those cuttings, you either put them in the ground next to the mother plant, so to speak, or you put them in pots with potting mix, and you keep that cutting watered every day, and it will develop roots in the soil, and then it's very adaptable.
Okay.
If you want to just keep taking cuttings, those young plants then brought inside in September, October, and put on a sunny windowsill, they'll grow and mature over the winter in your house, and they won't keep trying to go to seed as quickly. If you leave the mother plants outside and let them go to seed, wait until that seed head is dried out and brown and the weather's been dry for about a week, and then very carefully, having somebody hold a sheet of paper or a newspaper underneath the seed head, you clip it off with scissors, and the seeds will roll out onto the paper or the newspaper, and then you bring that inside, and again, you got a pot with good drainage, you got good potting soil. You put the seeds in there, you cover them with another quarter inch of potting soil, you keep that soil moist, you'll get baby plants that will grow for you indoors over the winter. Free color. Bringing in plants like this and starting them from seed in the winter, it's a better cure for seasonal affective disorder than one of those light boxes.
Great. Well, I'll keep at it then.
All right, yeah. You're already halfway there.
Yeah, that's terrific. Thanks, Mike.
All right, good luck, Bob.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody with a cut Christmas tree in the house to make sure that the water reservoir under that tree is always filled. Because if it dries out for just one day, sharp and green your carpet will be. But don't go hauling that H2O just yet, because we'll be right back to husk, wash, cure, and crack your nuts and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And believe it or not, the question of the week is about black walnuts this time out. Yeah, I know we've had shows where entire phone calls recently were about black walnuts. But you know, we've never had anything in print that people could look up to learn how to wash, cure, and crack those nuts in preparation for making those Christmas cookies we keep talking about. So we're going to take care of that business after lots of your cracked phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Andrew. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. How are you today?
I am just ducky, Andrew. Thanks for asking. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, there was a discussion I heard the other day about someone that had plants that they were concerned about at a home that they were selling, and they were talking about moving the plants, and your discussion was, you know, that it wasn't really a kosher thing to do, to take plants after you've sold someone's home.
Right.
Well, I have a situation where I did sell a home, and upon selling it, the purchaser came in, and a member of the family was taking this purchaser around the backyard and showing them our collection of azaleas, which we had quite a collection, several different varieties, multiple large bushes. And she made the comment that she had a large Doberman that would probably eat these plants and that the plants probably did not have a bright future.
Mm-hmm.
So we backed up and adjusted the sales contract and stipulated in the sales contract that we could move the plants.
Right.
And she agreed.
Great.
So these plants were all in full bloom.
Right.
We dug them up, put them in the back of a truck, and we hauled them down a highway about 40 miles an hour with the blossoms blowing off of them down the highway.
Right.
But the advantage to that was that in our new garden at the new place, we were able to place them by color to really make a beautiful setting, and I don't think we lost a single one.
You're a very lucky man, because generally the thing that would bother me about what you said was the truck. When you're moving plants like that and you're driving at 40 miles an hour, that's right. Like taking the plants through a nor'easter. That's where you want to put burlap over the top, or you want to plan a route where you can drive at 20 miles an hour or be in the service lane with your flashers on. But, okay, so far so good.
The issue that we have here, though, is that we're on a slope, and we do tend to have a soil here that has a lot of clay in it.
Mm-hmm.
And although we've not lost some of the bushes, we have some of the smaller ones that now have been in the ground for 2 years, and although they seem to have healthy foliage, they've not bloomed.
Mm-hmm. You said they were in full blossom when you moved them, so was that in the spring?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I probably would have dodged the bullet until the blooms were off and then moved them, because when the flowers are fully open, the plants are the most fragile. But as you found out, moving them in spring is not a bad time in general. Have you done anything to improve the soil around them?
Yes, sir. I do a very large leaf mulch pile every year, and I've been putting leaf mulch on them for 2 years now.
Okay.
I have a good few inches of dark topsoil now on the ground around them. One thing that I'm concerned is that if I continue to mulch them like I have been, that they're eventually going to be too deep in the ground. I'm going to have to raise them up a little bit.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do. Now, at this time of year, any buds for next year, you realize, would have formed already. So have you been able to examine the plants to see if there's been budding?
I don't see any buds.
Okay. So it's not the worst situation, because you say the plants are basically healthy.
They appear to be, yes.
Okay. So what I want you to do in the spring is I want you to hoe away or rake away all of that composted leaf material. And I want you to go to the garden center. I want you to get a bag of what's called rock phosphate.
Phosphate.
Rock phosphate. This is a mined mineral, very natural, very concentrated. A little bit goes a long way. A figure like a quarter cup at most for each azalea.
Okay.
So on the barest ground that you can create, I want you to spread evenly the rock phosphate around the plants. Again, no more than a quarter cup close to each plant. And then I want you to cover that with an inch of milled peat moss. I want you to buy one of those big bricks of peat moss.
Okay.
And spread that around an inch thick around your plants. And then you can either use the old composted leaf mulch or fresh shredded leaf mulch from this year, but an inch or two of that on top. Now, any flowers you get this spring will be a bonus. But that rock phosphate will become active just at the right time of year to induce new buds, new flowers to form. It should be the absolute perfect timing. And not because we're going to try to induce new buds on these plants. That's impossible. But it takes a while for a mineral product like this to become bioactive. But covering it with the peat moss is going to be good for the azaleas. They want that acidity in their soil. And then the organic matter in the compost or the composted leaves will actually help activate the mineral and make it more available to the plants, so that when the new buds are forming in the summer, they're going to be full of phosphorus. And if they don't bloom then, I'll eat my hat.
Should I do this every year for a few years?
No. The nice thing about phosphorus is it's a mineral, so it hangs around. It becomes active slowly over time, every 3 to 5 years tops.
All right. Well, thank you so very much for the information.
All right. My pleasure, Andrew. Good continued good luck, I should say, sir.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Yushi, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello. Yushi, am I getting your name correct?
Yes, that's perfect.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Where are you, Yushi?
I live in Philadelphia.
Okay. Well, the rules of the show is once you say Philadelphia, you have to name a neighborhood.
Oh, Rittenhouse?
Oh, you live on Rittenhouse Square?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I'm very lucky, and I work right by the park, so it's great view all the time.
All right. What can we do for you, Yushi?
Okay. So we have been trying to grow wheatgrass indoor for our grasshopper. We took in a grasshopper maybe 2 months ago.
Uh-huh.
But it was getting cold, and she just showed up on our door, and my husband took her in. And we tried to set her free, but she didn't leave. So we decided to just keep her. So, you know, the winter is coming, and we don't really want to go out to always find grassy area to cut grass for her.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to grow some wheatgrass. So my husband ordered some seeds from the internet, and initially it grew pretty healthy, very nice, and the grasshopper really enjoyed it. But very soon it starts to have gnats.
Oh, okay. That's not hard to cure. Now, okay. Isn't having a grasshopper indoors very common in Asia, and isn't it a good luck charm?
I think it might be cricket, but I don't really know.
I think you're right, but crickets and grasshoppers are very closely related.
Yeah.
But you also rescued a grasshopper. You're the first grasshopper rescue call we've ever
had. Yeah, but it's not just a grasshopper, because we also rescue a mantis.
Oh, okay.
It's been a very strange summer.
And are you eventually going to feed the grasshopper to the mantis?
No, they're just neighbors, and they can see each other. So the mantis really wants the grasshopper, but we feed the
Oh, this is better than television, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Somehow we turn into an insect refuge.
Well, it's easy. You don't have to walk them. You don't have to change the litter, you know.
That's true, but we want to make the grasshopper happy with, healthy grass. So we try to grow these, and they have gnats, but also we can't leave it just exposed because our cat wants the grass too.
Uh-huh, sure. A lot of times people will grow what's called cat grass for their indoor
right.
cats because the cats love to chew it and then throw it up onto the white carpet. Now, when your husband got the seeds, did they send crappy soil to grow them out in?
No, I used just Miracle-Gro soil for that.
Okay. Yeah. What I want you to do in the future, and if you've got a big bag of that, continue to use it, but it's no good for the grasshopper because it's got chemical fertilizers in it. So, you know, in the future, if you're going to continue your insect refuge, either get some just plain soil-free mix delivered to you or, you know, go out to a garden center in the spring. But don't worry about using it now. But you will have to get something called BTI, Gardens Alive, which supports the show. They actually sell a version that's approved for your problem, which is fungus gnats in the soil. These creatures are ubiquitous. They're all around, and they come in on us in the summertime. Sometimes they're in the potting soil. But, you know, sooner or later they show up around the kitchen waste or especially in cat grass or in wheat grass. And it's really easy. You get these granules mail order, and you take what you're going to use to water your grass, and you dissolve some of the granules in the water, and then you water that into the grass, and that kills the larvae that are down in the soil. And it's those larvae that when they come up, they come out as adult gnats.
Mm-hmm.
So don't be afraid to grow extra wheat grass, you know, for your kitty cat, and leave that out down low so it doesn't eat the grasshopper. And one container or a couple of, you know, however they come delivered, a little bit of BTI will go a long way. And in the summer, if you have a balcony or something like that, and you have mosquito problems, you can put out like little cat food cans that have been cleaned and they're filled with water with BTI in them. And the mosquitoes will lay their eggs in there and the eggs won't hatch. Mosquitoes and these kind of fruit flies, these kind of fungus gnats, they're all related.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is your cat could drink the BTI, the grasshopper could drink the BTI. It wouldn't affect them. The only thing BTI prevents is these flying creatures developing in soil or water.
That's wonderful. I mean, I really cannot stand little flying insects.
Yeah.
So this will help quite a bit.
And it's not a chemical. It's a naturally occurring soil organism. So it's completely mm-hmm. organic, completely harmless.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. And good luck with your insect zoo.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Janice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Janice. How are you doing?
I'm great and very grateful to be speaking to you.
And where is
show.
Oh, thank you so much. Where is Janice both great and grateful?
I am in Moorestown, New Jersey.
The Garden State. What can we do you for?
Yes, sir. I have a Schefflera tree, and I was just reading about it on Google because I finally found out what it is.
Right.
And it stays in the house all winter, and I take it outside in the summer where it really thrives. It loves it out there. But it's a problem to get it in and out because it's so heavy, so I don't have a bunch of friends standing in line to help me move this plant. So the night of our first freeze,
someone
was supposed to show up to help me, and they didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and covered her with blankets. And the next day when I went out there, all the leaves were icy-like and hanging straight down. So I brought it in and didn't know what to do, so I started cutting all those leaves off. So now all I have is, you know, a tree trunk that's completely bare. And I'm hoping she's not dead. I've had her for 44 years.
Well, you know, kids, Sparky was a happy dog while he was around.
Oh, no.
Well, you know, all things must pass, as George Harrison once said. I've seen this happen before. I have two gigantic birds of paradise that I exhibited in my final major exhibit at the Philadelphia Flower Show in 1997. And they are sensational plants. They flower for me indoors. I bring them in every year on a porch with a high-intensity light that comes on for a couple of hours every night. And I make sure to leave them on the porch late in the season. The tomatoes go out before the birds do. And I make sure they're the first thing I bring back inside. And it really is when I can corral a couple of my neighbors to help me heft these things. So, you know, it's possible it could regrow. What you would want to do is not attack it anymore. You know there's that natural aspect of pruning it, but the next thing would be gunshot wounds, and we want to avoid that. So just leave it alone. Don't water it. Is it in decent light, indirect light?
It's in decent light. I have it in front of a big window.
Okay.
But I did move it in front of a little heater vent.
No, get it away from there.
Okay.
Why don't you take it outside and run it over with your car? That may cheer it up.
No. I'll be so upset if I killed her.
You didn't kill her. You put a blanket over her and left her outside overnight. That was, you did the best you could. In the future, for instance, had you called, I would have said if you could find somebody with old school incandescent Christmas lights to wrap her up in those for the night, because they would give off some heat and maybe prevent frost from forming. But
that's a great idea.
But yeah, that's why I get the big money. But the blanket probably got wet and heavy overnight and did more damage than it helped. For people in future situations, if you don't have the lights, sheer curtains are actually better because all you're doing is preventing frost from forming. You don't want to weigh the poor puppy down. In truth, these plants do not have to go out in the summer, although, as you noted, they do love the summer.
Right.
They're originally from New Zealand, Australia, the Caledonias, very tropical climate. So one thing to always remember is you don't want to be waiting until the nights are predicted to drop into the 30s. You know, if this thing goes outside for June, July, and August, don't be afraid to bring it in early, mid-September, you know, kind of beat the Christmas rush. Because the plant would always rather not be out on nights that even dip into the very low 50s, much less 40s
okay.
or 30s.
In your professional opinion, do you think she's gone?
Yes. Not only dead, but really most sincerely dead. And any, you know, if you get new growth, then you can try to coax it along. Or
right.
you'll get another plant, you'll take even better care of it. And really, the secret here is not to push the seasons, to leave it in the house a little later than you might think and bring it back in a little earlier.
Right. That makes sense.
All right. I'm sorry, Janice. I'm sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you so much. And it was really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody in areas that dip below freezing that rock salt is the worst choice for plants, pets, and surfaces when ice is an issue. Instead, use sand, specifically play sand, or use alternative de-icers like calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, and potassium chloride. But don't go making a checklist on your periodic table just yet, because we'll be right back to crack some tough nuts and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to the question of the week, where we will detail for posterity exactly how to handle a harvest of black walnuts so that you get that nut meat to try to make your Christmas cookies with. And after that, no more phone calls about black walnuts. No more. None. Nada. But for now, more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Jeff. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
All right, the Garden State, right over the Ben Franklin Bridge. What can we do for you, Jeff?
Well, I've got a fig tree or bush. It's about 3 years old, and I got my first figs out of it this summer. And it was setting another flush of figs in the late summer. They were starting to grow, and I was getting worried about the cold weather setting in, and I should have made this call a lot sooner. But my question was, you know, how do I approach these new figs that are coming to help protect them from any cold weather? And as it turned out, we did get a freeze sometime in October, and that kind of like put a damp to everything.
Yeah, but so, you're ahead of the game, Jeff. Most people in Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New York, they struggle to get a single crop of figs. So you must be protecting this plant over the winter.
Yes.
And tell us what you're doing, because you're obviously successful.
Last year, I had some fencing that I put around it, and then I wrapped it in burlap, and I put some shredded leaves at the base, and that seemed to work. And I was very excited. I got about a half a dozen edible figs out of it from the first flush. And then, you know, going on to the next one, I was getting, quite a few nice little figs, and they were growing. But my anticipation of the cold weather coming in gave me many questions.
There was really nothing you could do. But if we plan perfectly for the future, we may be able to get that second crop in. Now, in the Northeast, where you are, in the Mid-Atlantic, a lot of people will tell you you need a specific variety to produce two crops a year, and a lot of luck and a lot of good handling. It sounds like your handling is close to perfect. When are you unwrapping your fig?
When I start to see a little bit of growth.
Okay, good. That's excellent. And then when you unwrap it, do you do any pruning?
I hadn't last year because it was still quite small. Now it's up to about 4.5 feet.
So when you unwrap it, which you can do a little earlier than later, these are Mediterranean plants, which means they can tolerate a fair amount of cold. They just need to be protected from the worst of winter so it doesn't die back to the roots. I would continue to unwrap when you are, and then I want you to get a pair of pruners, and after it greens up, I want you to remove any dead wood. If, for instance, we have a mild winter and you're flying high and there's no dead wood, I want you to give it a haircut. I want you to just take 3 to 6 inches off of every branch. That will stimulate a lot of new growth. It'll specifically stimulate new fruiting growth. And then when that first crop of figs comes in, the only thing we can do to try to move that second crop along is to harvest that first crop promptly. As soon as the figs are ripe, get them off the plant. Obviously, you don't want to pick them unripe, but you don't want to let them sit out there or the plant will not begin producing new figs. So when you get the old figs off, get out there with the pruners again. And don't go wacky, but just take an inch or two off the tips of every branch. See if we can stimulate that fruiting response a week or two earlier. When we get to the fall, if you have really good figs forming and a really cold night is predicted, set up your stakes and your burlap. Don't wrap the plant, but do make a windbreak around it. You could also go out and buy a row of what's called row cover. It's spun polyester.
Yeah, I have that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You could truly wrap the plant in that on the coldest nights, and that might prevent frost settling on the plant and stopping the production or the ripening of that second batch. But I think you are so close, so to speak, that you can taste it. Just those couple of little things, that little selective pruning for stimulation of growth and fruiting and a little bit of protection at the end of the season that is not going to be the same as putting it to bed for the winter. Just some frost protection as if you were coaxing a few last tomatoes out of your garden. And I think you're real close to getting a second crop, man.
Okay.
All right, man.
Great. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Jeff.
Take care.
1-888-346-9499. Suzanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thanks for talking to me. I love your show.
Oh, thank you very much for talking to me, Suzanne. Where are you?
Hockessin, Delaware.
What can we do for Suzanne in Hockessin?
My question pertains to not Hockessin, Delaware, but I have a home in Key Largo, Florida, on the ocean, and it took a big hit from Hurricane Irma, really wiped away most all of the landscape. And now it's just rubble and dirt and the seaweeds removed, but I need to put some ground cover back. And there's really no soil down there. It's a coral reef, so it's hard to dig, but there was grass growing there. I think it was mostly weeds, but for the amount of grass I had, which wasn't a lot, it at least covered the ground. I don't know if I should get sod or look into, you know, an alternative ground cover. That's why I called.
Typically, when somebody asks this question in general, you know, they've lost a lawn and they want to do something interesting. My recommendation is there are many low-growing plants that are aromatic and steppable, things like creeping thyme or low-growing junipers. They're not so much to walk on, but they do hold soil in place and recycle water and everything like that. Like I said, the low-growing thymes, there's so many of them, and they're aromatic, and you can walk on them. But no, I don't think you should put any lawn grasses back. Obviously, lawn grasses are not native to that area. But one of the interesting things, because it is still part of Florida, you should have an extension office, perhaps even there in the Keys, almost certainly there in the Keys, but the state extension for Florida should have a lot of information. Now, obviously, any information for like northern Florida, like up in Tallahassee, that's not going to apply to you.
No.
But when you get down to coastal Florida and where you are, you know, even well Baja of the coast, you know, probably there are some plant choices that would be dramatically encouraged.
Oh, for sure. Luckily, I went to the Key West Botanical Garden about a month before the hurricane and I just had the best time looking at everything and seeing the options that they had there. I bought the guide to all the plants, and I brought it home with me into Delaware to look through it. The hitch that I have is that it's a community where you're required to have like 60% grass cover. But I'm thinking as long as it's ground cover, I'll be fine.
If that's the case, you know, my experience with HOAs is they're not going to let you off.
Yeah.
So then I would go back to the Botanic Garden and I would talk to the most local extension agents that you can find and see there are some rare grasses, seashore grasses that are adapted to the southern United States that almost certainly would qualify, but again, would maybe even be native. Certainly be ecologically sensitive to your surrounding. And I've never seen one of these grasses that wasn't drop-dead gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good idea. There is an extension office in Monroe County in Key Largo, so I'll check with that.
And I think if you explain your situation, you know, obviously nobody's going to come out with a slide rule and try to figure out 60%, but if you got half of it in grass, maybe the rest of it doesn't even have to be a ground cover. Maybe you can get some really big, wonderful-looking containers and grow trailing plants down those, and they'd be a little more protected because they'd be out of the storm surge.
That's right.
But there are some grasses that are naturally salt-tolerant, that love hot summers, that I think would establish down there and have a lot of beauty.
Yeah. Okay.
All right?
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Well, good luck, and invite me down in February, okay?
Okay.
I don't care about the lack of landscape. Just get me out of an ice storm.
Yeah, we'll go in the kayak.
All right.
Okay,
all right.
You.
We're jealous. We're jealous. Right.
Thanks a lot.
Good luck, Suze.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling, okay, maybe you can eat black walnuts. As a special guest joining us in the studio today to help me with the question of the week is Courtney Cronenthal, who entered an auction at her son's school, of which the loser got to be on this show. Right, Courtney?
Something like that.
What's your son's school?
Gladwin Montessori.
Okay, very good. And now you've been roped into doing the question of the week. Aren't you sorry you entered that auction?
I'm ready.
All right, Courtney, please then get us started by reading this week's question.
I'd be happy to. Pete in the Andorra section of Philadelphia writes, "May I suggest you cover the topic of harvesting black walnuts? I know that some people consider the trees a pest and remove them from the landscape because they inhibit the growth of other plants, especially tomatoes. And the nuts are a mess to process. But harvesting and using them as food would be more popular if people had some pointers on the proper way to do it. Clearly, this person has not been listening to the show lately."
Well, that could be true. I had to go back to my emails from 2015 to find a written question about this topic. All of the chatter recently on the show about harvesting and eating black walnuts has come from the phone calls. Turns out that we've never done a question of the week on using them, just about keeping them away from tomatoes and other plants whose growth they inhibit.
You also got a recent email about all those phone calls from your old friend Doreen Paskoff of Hill Creek Farm in Pottstown, PA, who wrote, "Give it up, Mike."
Yeah, Doreen, who used to run a huge community garden and now has a small farm, wrote me to say that her experience with this topic is very similar. She has 200 blogs on her farm's website, but, quote, "everybody just reads the ones on black walnuts." So we're using those blogs and a University of Illinois Extension article that supplied some of her information to put together a black walnut how-to. Let's start with getting those green husks off.
Doreen puts 6 whole walnuts at a time on her driveway and presses a work-booted foot over each one until the hole slips off. She says that she tosses the holes into a box and the walnuts into a bucket, adding that you can hull a lot of nuts in a reasonable amount of time with this method, but you must wear gloves or your hands will be stained black and brown. Doreen continues, "Opinions are divided about composting the holes. Some sources say that if the composting is complete, the jug alone that inhibits the growth of other plants will break down. Others say to simply pile the holes up somewhere where they won't interfere with beloved plants. I use mine to fill in sunken areas around the farm, away from crops I care about."
The Illinois Extension article adds that the most recently dropped nuts have the sweetest flavor, and they recommend even shaking the tree to get really prime candidates. The meat in older nuts that have been laying around, they warn, can get dark and stronger tasting, so get those husks off right away.
Then comes washing. Doreen is fascinated with the technique of putting the hulled nuts into a small cement mixer. Add 3 times as much water as nuts, some small stones, and or a handful of grit, and quote, "let it rip." Doreen confesses that she will be haunting Craigslist next year for her own black walnut cement mixer.
Or you can place the nuts in a wire basket and hit them with a power washer to remove any remaining hull pieces and juice, with the warning that this rinse water is brown, brown, brown. So choose a spot you aren't picky about and where you aren't going to be growing tomatoes.
Next, the cleaned walnuts are laid out to dry in an airy protected spot where evil squirrels can't get to them for a month to 6 weeks. This gives you time to find your tool of choice to crack them. Everyone agrees that regular nutcrackers will not crack a black walnut. And most, quote, "black walnut crackers do not do the job either."
The Illinois Extension notes that cleaned and cured but uncracked nuts should stay fresh for a year in a cool, dry spot. When it is time to get cracking, they advise a heavy-duty vise for single nuts and a burlap sack for large numbers. Whack the sack repeatedly with a mallet, and then assemble a team to sort through and remove the nut meat. That meat should be allowed to cure for a day or two before being refrigerated in a moisture-proof container or frozen. And if you freeze it, that meat will keep fresh for 2 years.
But Doreen scored the best cracker of them all. the W.O. Weber Black Walnut Cracker. She explains that a senior citizen at her church heard about the task at hand and lent her his Weber. You put a black walnut into the little holder and crank the long handle down, reports Doreen, who added that you need to pull the handle down hard, but it crushes the shell around the nut meat nicely, and it doesn't take nearly the strength that a vise requires. Seated on a sturdy base, her Weber produces cracked black walnuts with only moderate effort.
Now, Doreen is going to have to return that cracker to its owner, but she hopes for its loan again next year. Right now, however, it's time for us to make cookies.
To help you do that, we will attach the recipe that our own Brett Rader used to make the cookies we sampled on the air a few weeks back when we post this question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. P.S. Brett's secret ingredient is to add 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract.
Well, that sure was some definitive info about getting ready for black walnut bacon now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to crack my... Oh, heck. Let's just say we're out of time and live to fight another day. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our parole officer, Sweet Staven Naomi Sterobin, has been relieved of duty by Terry Murray, our brand new vice president of production and criminal justice. Our engineer is Justified Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. And like us. Oh, and watch my TED Talk on composting and push it over 1 million views. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website viewable. Pushy Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our associate producer of Production Association and head chairman Oven Master is Brett Rader. Our special guest reader of the question of the week this week was Courtney Cronenthal. Our cookie-eating intern is Robert Fogarty. Asking for another plate is our editor, Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm not baked, but I am toasted. But I'll just scrape off the burnt parts and butter myself up so I can slide in to see you again next week. Ho, ho, ho. That's H-O-E, of course. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we celebrate the season with our annual Christmas Spectacular. Songs, stories, holiday plants, and more. That's the You Bet Your Garden Christmas Spectacular.